but the action is defined as
destructive and aggressive.
And then the Torah is concerned about your perfection. You should not perform that action,
which is destructive.
And so you should never
be makal. First, I have to show you that being makal tamal
is a destructive action. It is a makal tamal.
Now, once that's fixed, you should not perform that action. Even if in this situation, it's kind of not going to produce that effect, that's going to be up to you. So the idea, again, the same thing with Lashon Hara. The same thing with Lashon Hara, that action, the whole foreign system, everything that's supposed to do is first and foremost is because it's connecting to your soul. Of course, aside, it has to be something that's able to say. Healing, for example. Healing is how it actually helps you feel calm. But it's still prohibited. It's even in a case where it wouldn't harm the person whatsoever. You can put an eye there, a billionaire, a billion, a guy can have 10 billion, and you steal 2 cents from it, or a penny from the person.
That's the complaint.
It's a camera. It's a devil. Now you can't tell me that
it's a person.
It's a killer. But the action by extension is one which is destructive of you to be engaged in devil in any form. So, that's my answer over here, that you can't be makar. Once we have established that
be makar
and be engaged in a very destructive type of a verbal behavior, therefore it's prohibited.
Whether
the action results in harming someone, it doesn't result in harming you by performing it.
The same is true of Lashon Hara.
The question is remains
whether a person has to
be in a constant state of tshuva every day.
So first of all, let's clarify the.
When we say constant state, it's impossible. The person, no, it's impossible. The person's energy
is focused only on one thing, which is tshuva.
Yeah, which doesn't make any sense because
tshuva is
a necessary step in protecting oneself. It's a component in one's life.
But presuppose that a person is living a life.
Can't be therapy.
Person's not involved in therapy, doesn't make any sense
because you have to be engaged. Your therapy is a means to an end.
To function
at something better. So you can't be always involved in your therapy. What's the point of it if he's never going to be functional?
So
therefore
in this sense, that the tshuva is not
only for a certain time of the year.
But rather it's an ongoing process.
Part of a person's perfection demands that he be involved in the process of tshuva.
The process of tshuva means to be engaged
in introspection, self-consciousness, self-awareness.
But the kind of self-awareness which is
critical and positive
for the sake of improving himself.
That a person should be derived to. The person should be engaged in all year long. However, he can't be, it's impossible that he should be only
preoccupied with doing tshuva.
He has to be living his life. If he is
improving himself, he's incorporating
the improvements, and then as he'll notice changes in himself.
He will overcome.
Now, the point of tshuva is to overcome defects. So he will overcome defects. And then he'll go on to other problems that he has.
That's a progressive kind of thing.
But it doesn't mean in the sense that he's always preoccupied.
Then he can't be functional. He's always preoccupied.
Yeah, the question of Hashkacha,
so we said that when we read
Mishma,
that if you keep the mitzvah, then God will reward you.
The concept is not that
the purpose of doing mitzvah is to bring about a material reward,
but rather the purpose of doing mitzvah is that the mitzvah is its own reward in the sense that it brings you to a higher level.
It's to perfect you, and actually, the
direction of perfection is really to be less
involved in the physical world
as a value in itself, as an end in itself.
Therefore, according to the proper understanding of Torah,
the idea of reward for keeping the Torah doesn't make any sense. That's the first thing we have to understand. The idea that there should be a reward for keeping the Torah truly doesn't make any sense. Why is that so? Obviously.
Yeah.
So
So why shouldn't that be rewarded? Yeah. In other words, you can't be rewarded for a reward. It would be absurd. In other words, I'm telling you that I'm going to give you something which is the greatest good. So a person will be excited just to have the opportunity to have it. You have to say, now you can't tell me that you need the incentive. In order to enjoy this good, I'll reward you. As a reward for that, you're going to
buy a new basketball.
And the thing would make sense to him. Unless you're telling him that in addition to these things, I'm doing this as well, but not as a reward. The
idea of reward meaning
implies that it's for something which is painful.
I have to be compensated.
It implies compensation. That's a very strong question.
How can Judaism talk about reward when Judaism itself proclaims that it itself is the greatest reward?
And obviously, it's a little painful at the beginning. But that doesn't warrant reward.
Because there are many
enjoyable activities that are a little painful at the beginning.
For example, when you want your father to teach you how to drive.
So that itself, when you just teach me how to drive, you'll be thrilled. You're not going to ask for a reward.
You'll think of what am I going to do for him?
But certainly you're not going
to teach you how to drive, but he has to give you a reward for that.
Right. But it's painful at the beginning.
It is painful at the beginning because the car stalls, it's a
shift car, whatever it is, and
it's not that enjoyable. There's a lot of pain involved at the beginning.
But you stick with it because you have this vision in your mind. You'll be cruising along and having a great time. He gets the pain.
But you get a certain amount of pain.
Any activity, skiing, you want to go skiing, you know there's going to be a certain amount of pain. But you keep with it.
Anything you stick with.
So therefore, that pain in your mind does not necessitate a reward. If that's the case, then Judaism finds itself in a contradiction.
And I have a question which everybody takes for granted.
Okay, so someone suggests that reward doesn't necessarily mean that you're getting paid from an extraneous source, but the reward could be a natural result,
which is true.
That the person who follows the Torah will be functioning in a better way and will achieve greater progress in the material world.
But the Torah goes beyond that.
Right? It's clear that it is a special dispensation from God.
Out of the framework of the natural order,
precisely because you have followed his commands, will he reward you? That's the Shema. So,
while Hansen does have a point,
it is true that the natural.
That's what it says,
Oref Yamim Dinina, this is what
your idea is expressed
in the Torah itself. Oref Yamim, length of days, Dinina
is in its right hand.
The right hand means the essential function of Torah.
The Smola,
in its left hand, Osha V'chavar.
Smola means like a secondary.
The secondary benefit is Osher as wealth
and honor.
Which means that if a person is following the Torah and is living a rational life, he will succeed as an indirect result.
He'll naturally be better in business.
He'll naturally be better in the dealings of people.
Not as a reward from God, because
as a result of his own perfection.
So that is true. That's one level of reward. But the Torah goes beyond that.
The answer that we could have negative knowledge of God does not solve the problem of the mitzvah of love.
Because negative knowledge is not sufficient.
If I describe something to you in the sense of what it's not, so that type of an understanding is not one which facilitates a love.
You can say that's
impossible. Because the love means you have to attach your emotions to something. And the way the human psyche functions, it's got to be something where there's some kind of an image.
Rebuttal
on that point. The idea that someone benefits you, but you don't know who he is, and therefore you can form a certain attachment, and you want, even so, it's questionable. I don't know if I would call that love. Because I was saying, for example, if somebody
described a girl to you,
or a wonderful quality, I don't know if that would be love until you actually
met her.
Although we did say, see, we discussed this, we did say that a person could form love via a telephone relationship, or even letter writing relationship. In which case,
no, that was a
touch. That was a blind person.
And which, yeah, a blind person.
People spend a fortune on these telephone calls
to these possibilities that you've mentioned.
We said that in all those cases, through letter writing or through telephones and so forth,
if a person does fall in love, it's only because he creates an image in his mind. Now, all of us, that's what love is all about. Even if you've met the person, I want you to know, when you fall in love, love at first sight and all of that, it's not with the person per se. You're falling in love with an image. That person simply triggers off an image, and you project the rest onto the person. Even if you're seeing the person is just a vehicle for the creation of an image in your own mind. It's something you should think about. You never fall in love with a person unless you're on the philosophical level and you love the person for their virtue. But when we talk about typical romantic love, it's not the person. This is a very vital point. And therefore, since we say that you're falling in love with an image, then it's not necessary to even see the person for that image. When you speak to a person, so there's certain accidents, the voice, the humor, the personality, so it all comes through. And that can come through even in letter writing. So once enough of that is filtered through, bingo, you create the picture in your mind, and you're convinced this is the one, and you've fallen in love. Now that's multiplied by God. It's an impossibility, because if that is the case, you're creating an image of God in your own mind, which is totally false, and it's very idolatry. So that answer won't work.
In the Rambam. Now, interestingly enough, usually the Rambam does not bring in history in the Mishnah Torah. He deals with the mitzvahs and the halachas that pertain to the various mitzvahs. But in this case, he devotes an entire chapter to the history behind the subject of the laws of the Chacham. That itself is unusual. He doesn't get into the halachas until Perek Sheni. Alright, so let's go through this. It's a very important Perek. Alright, Perek Rishon. The Rambam says like this. He may Enosh, in the days of Enosh. Now Enosh was one of the early people who lived prior to Avraham, of course, but prior to Noach. I don't know exactly which generation you... Yeah, you could check it through. But he was a righteous individual. He was a righteous individual. Tov b'nei ha'adam. Because in the days of Enosh, mankind erred. Tos gedola. A very great mistake. Now, what does it mean, a very great mistake? When the Rambam says a great mistake, what does he mean? What would you say? Well, see, the term a great mistake to be made can be understood in two ways. It can be in the nature of the mistake. That's one thing. But it could be in the area. See, the Rambam says in the Mori Vochem that if a person makes a mistake in thinking, so it's bad. Any mistake is bad because it takes him away from the truth. Right? So, of course, you have to consider the extent of the mistake. It could be a minor or it could be a major. That's one thing. However, for example, in medicine, when a doctor is treating a patient, so with regard to a certain aspect of the treatment, let's say he gives him a whole regimen. The most important things, the medications he has to take and what he has to do and so forth. Then down, as you go down the list, there are things that are of lesser. How much exercise he should get, let's say what type of clothing he should wear. It goes many, many details. So let's say he makes a mistake in one of the areas. All right? So if the area is not that significant, but then the mistake is not that consequential. However, let's say he makes a mistake with regard to... he should go for a walk, however, for 20 minutes a day. Well, let's say, in truth, it would have been better if it had been 25 minutes a day. So it's not going to make that much difference. It's a mistake, but it doesn't have such consequences. However, if he makes a mistake with regard to the dosage, he's taking pills for hypertension, and the dosage, a mistake over there, can have serious consequences. That's the Rambam means. The Rambam says Torah Gedola means it's a very great mistake. Because this type of a mistake can be destructive, can have destructive consequences. So therefore, we're going to have to try and understand what's so great about this mistake. The Nivara Atzat Chachmei Oto Adar. And the thinking, the idea of the wise men that generation was completely taken over, was consumed by this mistake. In other words, this mistake was something very interesting, why it should be that way, but all the Chacham, for some reason or other, were tripped up by this mistake. The Enosh Atno Minat Tolem Hoyu. And Enosh himself was among the Tolem. Funny way of putting it. Because first he said it occurred in
the minds of Enosh.
Seems to be just in that time period. And then he says that all of the Chachamim of that generation, all the wise men of that generation, were involved. It's so interesting to notice that sometimes you have to be very, very careful. I think it's a Musa Haskell over here. You have to be very, very careful. Because most people tend to go along by, they follow an individual who's charismatic, or they think he's a great thinker. Or sometimes they won't because he's rejected by the other thinkers of the generation. But and they follow the majority. They want to be in line with the wise men of the time. But here you see that there's no ultimate guarantee. The Rambam puts that in, that the wise men of the time also were in error. So what do you see from this? So what's the person supposed to do? What am I supposed to do? I'm following. What is the person to do? The answer is that there's no ultimate guarantee in this world. A person, first and foremost, has to, you see how important it is to be able to think for yourself. You see how important it is in the others. You really cannot put your faith in other people. You can only put your faith in God. And, of course, you'll tell me, but each person is going to be a post-egg for himself. You must go through Chachamim, but you have to be able to derive from Chachamim the methodology and what's clear and what makes sense, but also to be able to distinguish the truth from the false, because you have to realize that even Chachamim can be an error. You can't have blind faith in Chachamim. So when you study someone, this is a dangerous thing. It's a dangerous thing. See, the world operates usually by categories, by absolutes. Either the person is right or he's wrong. So he's in or he's out. He's in vogue or he's out. And philosophy, sometimes certain philosophical movements are in, then they're out. But very few people can, because people relate to it and they have to identify with it. You see the whole thing with the Kahani phenomenon. There's Mayor Kahani. Either people like him or they didn't like him. But the truth of the matter is, it's not that simple, because a lot of the things, a lot of the ideas that he had made sense. I happen to have agreed with a lot of the things he said, and in his way of analyzing things. And many of the things that happen today, he's been predicting for years. So he had a lot of chachma in the area. It doesn't mean to say, however, that I accepted everything and all of his methods. His tactics, his methods, or all of his ideas necessarily. And most people can't be in that situation. In other words, I related to him, the way I related to him was I would read, I would listen, and I'd sift. That which made sense, I would accept, and what I found very useful. And that which didn't, I rejected. Because it had nothing to do with Kahani. If it came from Kahani, it has to be true, or it has to be false. But most people couldn't do that. Most people either liked him or hated him. Because they're not interested in the ideas, they're interested in the personality. And that's dangerous. That's very dangerous. In Yadus, you have to relate to an individual who has knowledge in such a way that you can gain from him, but you retain the critical ability. Because you see that all the Chacham of one generation can become corrupted with false ideas. Avi? Now, what was the big mistake? V'zuhoi said to Usam, this was their mistake. Amru, they said, Harol v'harol kim barak hachav nevu, since God, see, they believe in God, created these stars, the Galgalim, and the planets, the entire solar system. Vahani gets the Olam to guide the world. Unisanam b'maro, and place them on high. V'cholak lehem kavod, and God gave them a position of honor, established for them a position of honor. V'hem sham mashim, and they are servants. Hamsham shim lefanav, who served before him. Ru'uyim heim l'shabcham, they are fit to be praised with a forearm and to extol them, v'lachlo v'hem kavod, and to give honor to them, to show honor to them. By their concept, their scientific ideas were, maybe they were, of course, by today's standards, they were primitive, but the way they understood it, there was a relationship between the lunar and the sublunar, and in such a way that the actions, the movements of the spheres had an effect upon what happened below, on the earth below, and that this was the will of God, that God had set up the system this way, and therefore we could sort of picture it. God related to the world through certain spheres, through certain creations of his. And these their idea also was that these were like living beings that had souls. That these beings, these spherical beings, were not just physical, but they had, I believe that was their view. And therefore, they could be construed as beings that were entrusted with certain tasks. That was their concept, their scientific concept, in the same way that a commander sets up a system, and in that system he entrusts certain individuals with the power to carry out his objectives. So too, that idea applied to the way God had designed the world. That was their understanding of the situation. Now, so far, it doesn't seem so terrible. It was mistaken, but we have to discover what the Torah is about. Yes? V'zeh ratzon hakel. And this is the will of God, Baruch Hu. But gadel l'chabed, that we should honor and extol mi shegidlo v'chibdo, the one that God has honored and given a great position to. Kemosha melech rotza l'chabed avadav ha'omdim l'fanav. Just like a king desires to honor the servants that he places before him. And this is the honor of the king. So what do we see from this? This teaches us something unique about our concept of idolatry. You see that the early Ovdei Avodah Zarah believed in one God. They were monotheists. So one can be a monotheist and be in Ovdei Avodah Zarah simultaneously. The essence of Avodah Zarah is not the negation of monotheism. You see that clearly from this. You see that clearly from this Rambam. So far we don't see what's such a terrible mistake. Even Sha'ala Dava Zalivam, once they took this matter to heart, once this idea became entrenched, Hishilu Livnos Lakachavim Hechala, they began to build to the stars and temples, Ulahakiv Lahem Karbana, and to sacrifices to them.
And I'll give sacrifices.
Alright. Okay, we're going to try and go through this step by step. Ulashapcham Ulafaram, to praise them, to extol them, bidvarim, with words. Ulahishtachvos Mamulam, and to bow down after them. Today, Lahasig Raton Habore, in order to, for what was their whole purpose behind all of this? To serve God. Interesting that the motivation of the original idolaters was the service of God. They wanted to get close to God. Yet the Rambam says this is a horrible mistake. What you see, another thing that emerges from this, a very fundamental idea of Yahadus is what? Exactly. People can't accept it. That according to Yahadus, your own intentions, the intentions that you have, no matter how powerful, no matter how good they seem to you, if they're not in line with God's will, are totally worthless and dangerous and destructive. As you obviously, you cannot serve God in your own way. You see that clearly. Because the early Ovdei Avodah Zarah, at this stage of the game, they were intelligent people. They were chacham. And their entire purpose was to fulfill the will of God. But since that was mistaken, they were making a mistake as to the will of God, so they were Ovdei Avodah Zarah. And they were involved in the worst mistake. So good intentions in the area of Yahadus are not always beneficial and can be very, very destructive. No, sometimes it's destructive. Better off if you didn't act on your intentions. Kedei lahasik ritzon habore, in order to fulfill the will of God, b'da'atam hara, with their evil intention, with their evil ideas, with their false ideas. Evil means false. That's all the Rambam means by evil, is that it's false. It's not true. And this was the essential, this is the essence of Avodah. The Kachayim Omer Mavdeha Ayodim Ikara. And this is what the worshippers who understood the principle dead. Lo shame omrim, she'en sham eloka, elokoch abzeh. They didn't say that there was no God except this star. Who sheyir miyo omer? This is what Yirmiyo says. Milo yirocha melech agayim. Ki lecho yahasa. Who will not fear you, king of the nations? Because unto you is their praise, is their desire. Ki v'cho chachmi agayim v'cho malchusim ayin kamocha. For amongst all of the chachamim of the Goyim and all of their kings, there is none like you. Ubiachas yivaru v'yistolo. And as one, they became foolish, and they got involved in a big mistake. Musar havolav etu, kloma. Hakol yodim she'atahu levadecha. That is to say, that all know that you are the God alone. Interesting idea. Suddenly everybody recognizes the true God. But their mistake and their foolishness is shemadanim, that they imagine shazir I have over tanchuru, that this foolishness is your will. This is an interesting idea. So well, let's analyze it. First of all, what was the gravity of this mistake? All this, what does that mean? This is Torah's guttle. What was the underlying cause of the mistake? On the surface, it does not seem to be such a terrible thing. It may be wrong, but why is it such a big mistake? And also, why is it the essence of idolatry? Because we imagine idolatry to be the negation of God, belief in false God. Yet here the Rambam says that these people were intent upon relating to God, except they made a mistake. The mistake that they made is does not seem, on the surface at least, to be such a terrible mistake. They wanted to give honor to God, and they had this false picture of reality. In this picture of reality, it would seem to them that God wanted us to honor those whom God had honored, and in fact, this is an honor to God. In the same way, when you give honor to a representative of a king, you're not saying that he's the king. If the king sends an emissary, if he's not treated properly, that's an insult to the king, because he's a representative of the king. On the other hand, why is he treated properly with respect? Not because he's important, but only because you're showing honor to his relationship to the king. So, let's see if we can understand what was the nature of this mistake, and why this constitutes avodah zarah. Yeah? I mean, the person would not understand what is such a terrible mistake. All right, he would say, look, if that's, we shouldn't do it. We're not questioning that. If God says don't do it, we accept it. But most people wouldn't understand why it's so terrible. In fact, they would sympathize with it. They would say that if this is God's will, it's not God's will. They think if this helps the individual, if this is what the individual, that's what people say today. People have this idea that people have the concept that a religious intention is the only thing that matters. That's why they say there's really no, it's not important what religion you belong to, what denomination, because they think that all these things don't make any difference. It's the underlying attitude. If a person is religious, that he's a good person because he believes in a higher power. Since he believes in a higher power, so that's good. That's what they say. What difference does it make? We should all respect each other. You relate to God in your way, I relate. Why? What's the difference? But underneath it all, the essence of everything is the fact that we relate to a higher power. Judaism is here saying just the opposite. The exact opposite. That how we relate to God is the essence. The fact that a person is relating to God is not. It seems to be completely against the ordinary view. And at least on the surface, the ordinary view has a lot to be said to. And some people say that we're all religious. So we all relate to a supreme being. So what difference does it make if I have my rituals and you have your rituals? Well, why should this divide us? Why can't we respect each other's differences? Because underneath it, the essence is what counts. And Judaism is saying now, what you consider to be the essence, we consider not to be. What you consider to be the unessential, how we relate to God, we're saying that's the essence. Now, why is that so? Why is it idolatry? But they weren't being egocentric. I don't think they did it. This is the Chacham. they were operating with an idea. I don't see, was it really egocentric? It doesn't seem to be with an egotistical idea. That was their philosophy. They wanted to serve God properly. And they thought. They thought that this is what God wanted. So people were honestly, the Rambam said they were dishonest, they were honestly doing that which they thought that God wanted. And nevertheless, it was a terrible error. The first thing we see, as Avi and I point out, is that the entire analogy was inappropriate. Was inappropriate. Although on the surface it seems to make sense, and it is true that we do relate to God, in the sense of a king, but what they were doing is, when they were treating, you see, when they made the analogy, it's one thing to recognize that God is our king, in the sense that God is our ruler, and that everything that happens to us stems from God. Judaism makes a big point out of that. Of course, Malchus, any bracha which does not Malchus is not a bracha. But the error that they made is they went beyond that, and they began to project onto God what God would want. What God would want. They were, you see, they took the analogy too far. And they decided on their own that just as a king wants to give honor to those whom he has established, so too, God wants us to give honor to those to whom he has supposedly placed in an exalted position. That's the first step. But let's understand it. So what's so terrible about it? It's true. They shouldn't do that. And perhaps it's wrong. But what is, now let's get to the very concept. What you were giving us, the causality, is rooted. The root of this sin was an act of projection. Projection. They were projecting something onto God. Okay. But let's understand the projection itself. The substance of the error. What is so terrible about that? Because again, when you think about it, so what's wrong with that? It brings a person closer to God. Now let's say a person needs something to bring him closer to God. He looks at the universe, he sees God's creations, he sees that these things occupy a higher place in the scheme of things, therefore they are closer to God. So, maybe this is not God's will, I'm making a mistake about God's will, fine. But he says, Tod Gedolah. This mistake is a very serious one. So what's the seriousness? What is the content of the mistake that's so dangerous? And that is really the essence of idolatry. All idolatry, because we're going to read, maybe we should read what happened after this, because there is a continuation over here. Everything that flows, in other words, eventually, as we'll see, this led to a complete corruption of mankind and paved the way for the advent of Avram. But before we do so, let me just take a few possibilities, what you have in mind, and then we'll continue this. Ari? Ari is saying that perhaps they use these objects as an extension of God. I would say that Rama makes clear that the opposite is not. He gives you the analogy. They regard these objects in the same way as the ministers of a king. They are created beings. God created them, and we're simply giving them honor because indirectly we're giving honor to God. So I don't know if that's the case. The real problem is, why is this the root of Avodah Zarah? And the Rambam, interestingly enough, quotes a passage from Yirmiyahu. And that itself is strange, because Yirmiyahu existed thousands of years later. Yirmiyahu existed at the time of the destruction of the Rishon. And what he was talking about, was he talking about the primitive idolaters that preceded Avram? So it's very, that's selfish for what's he bringing a proof from Yirmiyahu as to what occurred then? Alright, but we'll leave that point for the time being. The question that we have to answer is, why is this the essence, the root of idolatry? When most people believe that idolatry is worship of a false God, here we see that the essence of idolatry has nothing to do with that one can be worshipping the true God. Indeed, we see that this was the way, where do we see this chait occurring in the Torah? This very same chait, the ego. This exactly is chait to ego. When the Jews created the ego, because Moshe tarried, he was late, and they said, this is your God, Israel, who took you out of Egypt. They didn't mean that the calf which they themselves had created had taken them out of Egypt. Nobody had that idea. But it was a return to primitive idolatry. It was a return. They needed an intermediary. They needed an object to relate to. So it is very similar to the mistake.
Physical intermediary.
Yeah, yeah. But of course, we haven't explained what's wrong with it. You see, this Ramah Halev is broken up into two parts. Part one tells you about the mistake that they made. Right? And the mistake was only not with regard to the nature of God, but with regard to God's will, how God wanted man to worship God. And the mistake was, as Daniel said, that it was the will of the king that we should give honor to those whom God had honored. Then it says, and we didn't really take up the connection, the logical connection. Kivin sha'ala davazal libam, as soon as this idea took hold, ischivu livnos lakachavim hechalav, they began to build temples to the stars, ulahakav lehem karbanos, and to bring karbanos to them, and to praise them, and extol them with words, and to bow up towards them, in order to fulfill the will of God according to their false ideas. Now, what is that second step? Is that, why does Ram have to mention that? That as soon as they, what's the significance of that? As soon as they had this idea, they began to build temples and praise them and sacrifice to them, etc. What's happening over here? A little more clearly. All these other things, the building of temples, the praising and the sacrificing, are these institutions that were in existence before, except now they were geared towards the stars, the celestial beings. That's the only change. Well, no, these are new institutions that came into being at this time. That's what I'm saying. That's what I'm asking. You did have sacrifices of time and heaven, correct? All right, very well could be that the Rambam is telling us that once, because he says as soon as this idea took root in their heart, once this idea occurred to them, they began to build temples to the stars. It could be that they didn't have these things before, because if they already had temples, it could say that they used the temples they had, the ones they had already. So it could be that along with this came the whole idea of what we know of as the accoutrements, is that the word? Accoutrements? The accessories of religion. All religions have these types of things. Religious practices. Temples, places of worship, praises, singing songs of praises, giving praise, sacrificing, and bowing. All of these different activities. Which, by the way, Yahadus, when Yahadus was established, and Yahadus is a system of worship which is directed towards the God of reality, it didn't abandon these things. It maintained temple, praising, and bowing, and so forth, and sacrificing. And the Rambam in the Mora, the Rambam's position is that really, these are not necessarily such good things, because they tend to cater to certain emotions in man, but the Torah had no choice. They couldn't have a religion that didn't satisfy these emotions, so these emotions were now redirected towards the true, the God of reality. But it could very well be that this is in line, that this mistake was not purely an intellectual mistake, but it was intended to gratify certain emotions. As we said, the whole mistake wasn't purely intellectual, it was founded upon an emotional desire to project certain emotions, or to project certain needs onto God. So they were relating to God through the framework of their emotions, how they imagined, what they imagined God would want. Now, once you're involved in relating to God through the framework of what your emotions would want, so that's a vodazara. That's a vodazara. Because you're simply catering to your own religious instinctual needs, and you're not getting away from that framework and dealing with the object of God of reality. So it could be that that's the Rambam saying. That once this idea took root, this idea was attached to other emotions, emotional needs. These emotional needs, because you could say like this, now it's alright,
so they wanted, they thought that God wanted them to relate or to praise the celestial being. But what you could do it at home. What do you have to have a temple for? But part and parcel of the mistake, included in the mistake, was this hidden emotional need to gratify their religious emotions, and that required a temple, that required sacrifices, that required a whole system. So you see the origin of a religious system over here. You see the origin of a whole system over here. And the Rambam says that that is the ikar of Avodas Hashem. That's the ikar. Did we define the ikar of Avodas Hashem? Think of this, where the idea of sacrifice comes from. But you see, it's a very old idea, and it almost seems as though it's innate, like an automatic response kind of a thing. Although we do see, in the case of Cain and Hevel, and in the case of Hain, Cain and Hevel, and Hevel was a tzaddik, right? Cain
was a
tzaddik
to thank God.
I'm sorry?
Was trying to thank God.
No, but I had to think of the actual burning of an animal.
See, if that's the case, well, that's one of the questions. And you see also, by the way, that Avram, Avinu, Yitzchak, they all brought sacrifices to God.
Because God told them to do it.
Alright, so then why is the Rambam against sacrifice? Why does the Rambam say that if a situation were ideal, in an ideal situation, we'd have a religion without sacrifices? Because sacrifices are dangerous. So it would seem that there's a certain ambivalence over here. On the one hand, it would seem that sacrifices are a good thing, desirable. You see that Cain and Hevel. But Cain's sacrifice wasn't accepted because sacrifice per se is bad. Because if that's the case, then Hevel wouldn't have been accepted either. God accepted Hevel. But Cain's was not accepted only because he didn't choose from the best of his fruits, which indicated a defect in his attitude. So it was an effective sacrifice, but the idea of the sacrifice itself, it would seem, was a good idea. So how would you answer this? In other words, there seems to be an ambivalence over here. The question about sacrifices. Whether it's a good thing, it's not a good thing, it seems to be, on the one hand it seems to be a good thing, on the other hand it seems to be not a good thing. We see in the case of Noah that after Noah came out of the chayla, after the marbles, but even Noah is Be'ech Hashem, he got the call of him, So you see that God accepted. It's described in very physical terms. God, so to speak, smelled the pleasant aroma. Well, it indicates that this was acceptable to God. So to speak, God was pacified. Of course, if we don't mean it literally. If that's the case, then the institution of sacrifice, it would seem to be, is a good institution. Why would the Rama be against it so much? But I think you have to say that there are two kinds of sacrifice. What was the, when the Rambam is speaking about the dangers of sacrifice, you see, there's a certain instinct, an instinctual sense or drive to bring a sacrifice. And that I think is basically innate. I think it's something that is derived from experiences in childhood. The idea of submission to a higher force. And to sacrifice, in other words, it's based upon the premise that higher force wants something from us.
Indeed.
I think that really stems from the childhood relationship to the parents. That's the model. There's a certain model in a person's mind. Every person has a certain model in his mind of how to relate to authority. And that model stems from his childhood experiences. So, in childhood, basically, the impression that the child has is that he's under the control of a stronger figure, and in order to get what he wants, he has to please. He has to do things that are, he has to sacrifice his own desires and please the parents. So now that's an infantile notion. However, that remains in the psyche of the person. Now, as he gets older, he realizes that the real powers, or he senses it emotionally, is not his father or whatever it is, but his concept of the deity, that there's a deity, that the universe is controlled by higher forces. But this follows the natural flow of those ideas, or those emotional ideas, those feelings, that's going to lead to sacrifice. Because he'll have a concept of a deity, whatever it is, and his idea will be that in order to get the protection of that deity, he has to make sacrifices to it, to submit to its authority, and to be ready. That's the idea of submission. Bowing down is really an act of complete submission. And of course, the Torah takes that action, since that action is very dramatic and has a powerful hold upon people's imagination. So we do that action within the confines, however, of the Mikdash, and under the proper system. That act of submission is directed towards the true God. So the sacrifices that the Rambam, I believe, is speaking about, is sacrifices is the natural instinct of a person. And it's based upon, the danger is, it's based upon the idea that God has certain needs that you can somehow satisfy. That is a very corrupt idea. It's a very dangerous idea. And that's part of the essence of Avodah Zarah. What we're saying, in effect, is we're making God in our own image. We're trying to understand God. We can't understand God, and we have to recognize that God is totally different. And there's no way we can know God. And as soon as we do any action which is based upon our own framework, and that's the mistake of the early Ovdei Avodah Zarah, and still exists today in people's minds. As soon as we do anything which comes from our own framework, makes us feel better, because we would that's the way we would want to be treated. As soon as we take those ideas, how we would like to be treated, how we treat people in positions of authority, and we carry it over to God, then we're in dangerous terrain, because that's not really God. That's something that we have created. And the reason why we've created it is because we have to cater to our own sense of insecurity. We want God's protection. However, there's another idea. See, the sacrifice that Noah brought was pleasant to God. So you can't say that sacrifice stemmed from an idolatrous emotion. And Hevel brought a sacrifice, and that was pleasing to God. So I think the other idea of a sacrifice would be, it stems from the rational part of a person, and that is that it's a recognition, that it's a rational recognition that he lives in a universe whose source is the Creator, and it's a breakdown of his own egotistical emotions. See, that was the idea when Noah, Adam, man before the flood, was extremely powerful, extremely self-confident. He couldn't recognize. He was completely caught up in his own sense of himself. He couldn't recognize that there was a being greater than him, outside of himself. So, in bringing the sacrifice, he was humbled. It was a humbling experience. It's a rational act of Yirat Hashem, as we learn, the fear of God, humbleness, and he recognizes that everything that he has is a gift from God. And of course you'll say, well, if he has that recognition, why does he have to bring the sacrifice? The sacrifice is an enactment. It's acting out an idea. And acting out an idea is very important in perfecting a person, because he's directing his emotions in line with that idea. So it means to say that he separates himself. He separates himself from his attachment to the physical and to his sense of control, and there's a rational recognition that he lives under the universe which has been created and which is controlled by God. So sacrifice can be the expression of rational ideas, or it could be just an instinctual reaction, or it could be it depends who's bringing the sacrifice and what his motives are. But it would seem that over here, this development of the construction of a chalos, a temple, this entire development was tied with their development of their false idea of trying to relate to God in an emotional way by projecting certain emotions onto God. And therefore, the Rambam brings in that along with this came a whole religious system with temples, with sacrifices, and so on and so forth. This was not a rational approach. Now, what happens after this? Take a look at Beis now. The Achash Arkhu Hayam, and after a long period of time went by, Hamdu B'Zei Adam B'Zei Sheker, there arose amongst mankind false prophets. The Amru, and they said, Shakel Siva, that God commanded the Amalam and said to them, Ibzu Kochav Ploni, worship this star, O Kol HaKochavim, or all the stars, V'akrivu Lo, and sacrifice to him, V'naschu Lo Kach V'kach, and pour such and such libations to him, U'v'nu Lo Heichal, and build to him a temple, V'asu Tzurato, and make an image of him, K'dei L'shtachlos Lo Kol HaAm, in order that all the people will bow down to him. Hanashim Vaktanim Ushar Amei Haaretz, the women and the children and the rest of the people, the masses. Humodiyo Lahem Tzuro, and he taught them a form in he gave them a certain form, Shabbadam Ilibo, that he made up in his own mind. In other words, it was a fabrication, he fabricated. But this is the form that God wants you to worship to. The Omer, and he said, Zuhi Tzuras HaKochav, HaPloni, that is the form of that star, Shehodiyu Bin Huaso, that they informed him about in his prophecy. V'eschilu al derech zu laso tzuros b'haychalos, and they began in this way to make images, forms, in the temple. The Sakafarilano, and under the trees, Uvarashi Ahorim, and on mountaintops, the Al Hagvot, and on the plains. It was Kaptim, and they gathered together, Umashakim Lahem, and bowed down to them. The Olim Lacholam, and they say to the entire people, Shazu Atsura, that this form, Mitziva Umareya, could do good or could do harm to you. Therefore, Huroi loved it. It's fitting to worship it. Uli Yiravimanu, and to be afraid of it. The Chohaneim Omrahim, and their priest, said to them, Shebachodazu, that with this worship, Kirbu, Vatatlichu, you'll succeed in your endeavors. The Asu Kachvakach, and do such and such. The Al Kachvakach, and don't do such and such. What does that mean? They set up a system of rules and regulations. Then I'm showing you really the development of religion. Yeschilu, let's just stop here for a minute. What is this development? How is this different than, you see there's different steps. Step one was the original mistake, the intellectual mistake, in which they said that it's the will of God that we should give honor to those whom God has honored. Step two is, once this idea takes root in their heart, they build temples, and they sacrifice, and bow down to it, and so forth. Now what is step three? Step three is in Halacha Beis, from the beginning until this point. That seems to be more or less what occurs in step two. What is new over here? We will study it carefully, Shulchan Aruch. The goal for us is to make it more structured. And you know, when things become structured, they become institutionalized. It's very important. It's a very important thing, both for the good and for the bad. If you have something good, you come with a new idea, but you can't organize it and make a system and a start. You see, if a person has a good idea, a way of teaching, or a system of ideas, so if he just has the ability to teach himself, but he can't create an institution to perpetuate it, then that's it. As soon as he's gone, the movement is gone. But if he can start a system, he can teach others and institutionalize it, then it perpetuates. You have perpetuation. So,
That could be for the good, if the idea is correct and sound, that's for the good. If it's bad, you have an evil system, like communism, whatever it is. Once it establishes institutions, it becomes part of the system, it perpetuates. So that's a natural result. So here you're having institutionalization, but since there are three particulars over here. In other words, what are they?
One is first you have to choose an object to represent what you're going to...
Significant. Now you have false prophets. The Rambam didn't mention false prophets before. False prophets were not present at the creation of this false idea. So what happened? What's happening over here? Why? What's the relationship between what happened before and the emergence of false prophets? That's the first thing. The second thing is, well, these false prophets, they now come with that God commanded and said to worship a particular. It becomes particularized. Before, it wasn't particularized. It was a general idea. Now, God has command to worship this one or that one or a bunch of them. Right? I want to build a temple to this one. And then, that's one. The second development is tsuros, images. Before, there was no images, if you realize. Before, in the first, in Halakha Aleph, he doesn't mention anything about images. He mentions worshipping these stars, the celestial beings, but there's no images. Now, there's a tsura. There's a image, and the image is something which he himself has made up in his own mind. But of course, he claims that this is what God wants.
Totally.
And the next thing is that he tells you what to do, things you should do, things you shouldn't do. Religious rules. How does that, you know, what's the cause of that? Okay, then he mentions also, and you can call this a fourth thing, I'm not being that medoctic in how many, umiskapsim, kibbutz, gathering together, communal worship. It's interesting how you see all the various steps of religious practices. Now, what's the causality over here? How do you go from the original intellectual mistake to this phase? Phase two is really the phase, as I say, as TV has said. It's basically the creation of religious structure, of religious institutions, to make it into something permanent, and it has all the elements that we know of today. I would say that these Nevi'im are exploiters. Everything becomes an industry at a certain point. It becomes that as a market. See, once the mentality of people had been prepared, they were no longer functioning on the rational level. The stage was set. They were functioning on the level where they needed something to cater to their emotional needs. And you see, even in Judaism, at certain points in history, when the people were not on a high level, so certain religious movements arose within Judaism to cater to the emotions of people.
Well, if you say that
the door was open for religious... What's a Navi Sheker? A Navi Sheker is a charlatan, a religious charlatan. And these are people that were, I suppose, charismatic personalities. And they may have even believed that God spoke to them. They were false. They may have even believed it. And, you see, there was this... People were looking for something. The religious instinct was now in full force. And people were very much looking for something to hold on to. So when a Navi came along, someone who claimed to be a Navi, and he was sufficiently charismatic, there was an audience. Prior to this, in the early days, there wouldn't have been an audience. People would have laughed at him. Because people were functioning on an intellectual level. But once people had made the preliminary moves, and they had given in to these emotions, so then, this is what happens. You see? It keeps going. It gets worse and worse and worse. Now, once you, that's in the process of Sartem, once you turn away from Torah, from relating to God intellectually, then you bring forth all the emotions. And you can't just stop it at one point. It keeps getting worse and worse and worse. So now there was a market for these problems because people aren't satisfied. You notice how it goes from the more abstract to the more, even the mistake. It starts out being pretty abstract, an abstract idea. that we should worship God through these intermediaries. That's an abstract idea, but it's not enough. So that's the first concession to the emotion. But that's not enough. So you have to have temples. You have to have something. You have to have sacrifices. But still, it's pretty abstract. Why? Because it's still an idea. You don't believe that the star... First of all, the star is not tangible. I mean, it's tangible. It's more tangible. God is completely not tangible. But still, it's very distant. And it's very conceptual. And it's very abstract. It's just a minor little concession. But that's not enough. Then you need... See, the prophets came along, and they had a tremendous insight, they had an intuition into the need of people. They sensed that it was too abstract, that people wanted something closer to them, something physical. And then they developed a full-blown religious service. Now, what does a full-blown religious service entail? First of all, it needs something that I can touch. It needs something tangible. So that's the tzuros, the images. Of course, they said this is not God. This is only a representative of what? Of the star, which is a representative. You finally see how they're getting further away from God, from the God of the Creator of heaven and earth? Because then the first step was they're dealing with God with an intermediary. Now, they're dealing with an image of an intermediary. Two steps removed. I'm sorry? Oh, it was a Avodah Zarah as soon as they began to worship the God through the star. That was the first step. That's Iker of Avodah Zarah. I'll get back to that. The essence of the Avodah Zarah, I made this is a very important point, that according to the Torah, Avodah Zarah is not necessarily polytheism. A person can be a monotheist and an idolater simultaneously. That's the concept over here. This is what we see. I just want to sum up this point for today. This is a very crucial step that the Nevi'ei Sheker have sensed that emotional need in Bnei Adam. And they're exploiting it by giving it something concrete. They want something concrete. They want to satisfy their religious emotions. That entails an object that they can relate to, because the star is still too abstract. That's a tzurah. And what else? Of course, now they have their own temple to the tzurah that gives them a greater feeling of security. And interestingly, also they have to have commands. Every religion has to have do's and don'ts, commands. There's something, right? In other words, they have to be told that their life needs structure. So what do we do? What do we do, in other words, to get the approval? Is it enough just to, what? Yeah, of course. But they have to feel, though, that they're living their life in a certain way. So a person has to feel that he has the right way, the right approach in life, and that this system tells them how to live his life. People need a structure. So then there's prescriptions, do's and don'ts. This is the way you're supposed to live your life. That's right. It may exactly. It caters to that feeling that God cares about you and he knows about you and this is what he wants you to do and this is what he wants you not to do. But it's really a restructuring of the whole infantile experience. And
what was the motive of the
I'm sorry? Yeah, it's like I would say they like these
evangelists.
So-called evangelists, these televangelists, what are their motives? Money. They all it's money is part of it, but fame. Power, exactly. To be a star, it's power. You can take a look, you can understand, it's interesting. What kind of people we're talking about. These are people that were obviously charismatic people. They were able to convince people that they had special powers and special knowledge.
In modern times also.
Yeah. Oh, because why is it? First of all, two things. These are charismatic individuals that convey a tremendous sense of self-confidence. Right? They have this tremendous... Many of them actually believe what they're saying. I don't necessarily believe that they're all calculating phonies. They're all phonies and exploiters. I mean, but on a certain level, many of them actually do believe in themselves. They do believe they're superior. They do believe that they communicate with God and so on and so forth.
And since they have such a strong belief in themselves, such a strong confidence, that has an effect upon people with a superstitious mentality, people that are not questioning by nature. So there is that need. People are looking, then the masses are looking for guidance. They're looking for guidance. They're looking for people who they can establish as being the ones who are in the know. And that then they set up their system. You have to have a system. Because you can't just come, people can't operate on the abstract level, and you claim to be the one that's in touch with God. So you have this idea now, the religious leader. What comes into being at this phase is the so-called religious leader. And he establishes the institution. And that, now the whole institution of religion is basically complete. This is a very crucial step, because you're going from the abstract, the mistake, but the mistake is still in an abstract form, so it's subject to correction. But once it becomes institutionalized and it becomes concretized in certain, in a whole pattern, in a form of worship, and you raise your children along these lines, that's when it becomes embedded and people can't question it anymore. And it's not an intellectual thing anymore. It's purely emotional. It's not open to discussion anymore. At that point already, it becomes extremely difficult to uproot the error. So the key point is, it begins with the Nevi'im, and it ends with the Kohanim, the priests. That's already a system. The system is the prophets. They're the ones who supposedly receive the message from God. And then, the fact that there are Kohanim, that there are priests, show that there's an organized system over here. And since people are searching for security, they've got to join the church. Now they join the church. That's phase two.
Then he says, after the Nevi'im came to them with specific commands to build temples and forms of worship and rules and regulations, then he says, "V'schilu kozim acherim," and then there began other what's kozim? Deceivers, falsifiers. Deceivers. The Rambam held that the original Nevi'im, the Nevi'i Sheker, were basically charlatans, as we said. Lamod v'lomar, they stood up and they said, Shakocha v'atmo, that the star itself, Al HaGalgo, or the heavenly sphere, Al HaMalach, or an angel, Gibor Imam, spoke to them, the Amalahem, and said to them, Ivduni v'kach v'kach, worship me in this and this way. So how does this age change? How is it a further corruption? What? Yeah. In other words, you see it's getting further removed from God. Because in the first instance, the Nevi'i Sheker, the false Nevi'im, at least they said that God told them such and such. So they still retained the idea of God. They were falsifying what God said, but they still were relating to God. Now, they're not even mentioning God anymore, but they're dealing only with the sphere, or the created being, who was only supposed to be an intermediary in the first place. And they then taught people, made known to people, the way of worshipping it. So here is a very crucial turning point, because now they're regarding the sphere, or the star, as a god in its own right. And vasukach, vialkach, sukach. And the same thing, rules and regulations. Do this and don't do that. Kupashat davazeh b'chol ha'olam. And this spread out throughout the entire world. Lavod es hatsuros, to worship images, bavodos mishunos dumidu, in forms of worship different from each other. Ulahakrav lahem, and to bring sacrifice to them, will ishtachvas, and to bow. Okay? V'chivin she'archu hayamim, and as the days pass, in other words, it takes some time for all this to become institutionalized and to become entrenched. Nishtakach Hashem ha'nichbad ha'nora v'ti kol ha'yakom u'midakam. Then the name, God's wondrous name, was forgotten from the mouths of all who were in existence and from their thoughts. Below he, they did not know about it.
So therefore, the true name of God, the true concept of God, was eventually completely lost, forgotten from mankind. That's the background to the emergence of Avraham Avinu. V'nimtzu kol'am ha'aretz, it turned out therefore that all the people, hanashim v'hazkanim, the women and children, einam yodim ela hatzura, shalei v'shalei. They knew nothing except the image of wood or stone. V'ahechel shalavanim. And the temple of stone, sheneschanku mekatnusam, l'shtachos lo, that they had been taught from youth to bow down to it. Uliavda, to worship it. Ulishala b'shma, and to swear in its name. V'achacham shalei b'hem, and the wise amongst them, to go into Anahem, for example, their priest, the Chayote Behem, or the like, Medalin, She'en Sham, Eloka, they imagined that there was no God, Elohakacham, Vagagalam, She'nasu Atura Se'elu, Beglolam, Vudmusam, except these stars and spheres, that the images had been made because of them, and in their image. This was the situation. You had the ordinary people. The ordinary people believed in the image itself. They believed that the image itself was the power. Crazy as that is, because that's something which they had made with their own hands. They didn't even know that this was a representation. However, the so-called wise people, the ones that were the religious teachers, they recognized that these images were only representations of the star or the sphere, but they couldn't go beyond that. Yes, aval tzura olamim, but the rock of the world, which means the creator, lo hayah shem adam shehayah makiro, there was no man that recognized him, v'lo yodo or knew him, ela yechidim ba'olam, except for certain yechidim, kigon chanoch, umus tushelach, noach, shem ve'eva. So, yes, interesting why you even have to mention this. His main point is that, for all practical purposes, the knowledge of God was lost from all of mankind. So he mentioned it except for a few. But these few, apparently, had no ability to influence others, as opposed to Avraham, when he discovered the true ideas. I'm just a very good question. Because, how does this story, this history, fit in with the history of the flood? Because the deterioration that we're talking about over here begins before Noah. He says it began in the days of Enosh, in the generation of Enosh. And Enosh was before Noah. And in the days of Noah, all of mankind was corrupted. And it does not say that they were destroyed because of the sin of Avodah Zarah. It was depravity, sexual depravity, and basically oppression of people, one person against the whole breakdown of human society, which doesn't really mention anything about Avodah Zarah. And Noah was static. And Noah was not an Obed of Avodah Zarah. And here you see the Rambam mentions Noah as being a yachid, an individual who knew the truth. It's also strange. In general, why would he mention Noah? It's strange to mention Noah in this thing, you know, as this thing from the rest of the world, in contradistinction. Because what do you mean? At the time of Noah, he was the only person. There was Noah and his family. So what do you mean? Noah was an individual who had the truth, as opposed to who? His family had the true ideas. And there was no world to talk about. So what happened afterwards? That's really what the question should be. There's a gap. It seems that the Rambam over here is telling the story as though there was no flood. He's telling the story as though there was no flood. Because if you take into account the situation of the flood, then there should be two parts to the story. There's the development that occurred up until the time of the flood. Then from the, after Noah comes out of the table, from that point on. The Rambam omits that. It's a big mystery to me. I don't have the answer for it. It would seem that this entire process was
cut off at the time of the Marvel. The Marvel should have cured that. Then Noach emerged, and Noach had the true ideas, and he should have taught the true ideas to his children, and so forth. So the true ideas, so at that point, was the point, what's that?
But Noach,
but that was Noach's son, Shem and Abram.
Shame,
you know, some grandchildren. So what do you have to say? It's not an easy question, because what you can say is that this process of idolatry was continued, was resurrected by the other sons of Noah, perhaps. But that's not what the Rambam is saying. So I don't know. I don't know how we connected. He's there. He's talking over here as though there was another interruption, because he mentions that Noach had the truth and Shem and Aver. But if that is the case, if Noach did have the truth after he came out of the novel, so what happened to the rest of the world? They were all educated with the true ideas. So then, if they then became corrupted, how would you say that their corruption was a result of the mistake of Enosh? All those people that had been affected by the mistake of Enosh supposedly were destroyed by the flood. So now the Rambam requires a new explanation. That's a good question. What the idea is saying is that we have to assume, therefore, that Noah had three, Shem, Cham, and Yafet. That Shem had the true ideas, but the others were corrupted by the false ideas, and they carried along. It's possible. It's possible, I don't know. It's possible that at that time of the flood, they were not at that level where they were seeking the most primitive form of idolatry. But they did have the mistake of Enosh with them. Apparently, just to give some kind of an answer, what we must conclude is that the sin, the error of Enosh, was not corrected by the flood. It did not correct that error. That error remains. Noah himself did not partake of it, apparently, nor the chain. But others in the family did partake of it, and it was carried on, and apparently it continued. Because the Rambam doesn't even mention how it survived through that break. All right, let's continue. Avol Tzura Amai. V'al Derech Zeh, Hoya Ha'olam Holech Umizgalgel. And in this way, the world continued to evolve. Which means to say that it reached, you see, there was a developmental point, it went through certain processes, till it reached the final phase. And the attitudes of mankind were then set. The thing is, you have to realize, within these areas, that once a mistake becomes institutionalized, it's very hard to uproot. Because you're dealing with very powerful emotions, the religious instinct. So once you set up a religious system, all these different cults, the time to uproot them, the time to destroy them, is when they're first being formed. People are not affected by them, they're new, and the people are questioning them. See, in the formative stages, that's when you can combat this type of a thing. But after the formative, survives the formative stage, then it's established. So what they do is now the children are being raised in a certain way. And these ideas are being embedded in their minds and in their very powerful emotions that prevent them from questioning these things. So this is exactly what happened. There was an evolution until the world removed itself completely from the knowledge of God and became totally entrenched in the idolatrous system. And it's very hard to deal with that, because that affects the way the person feels. What emotion does it appeal to? It appeals to his conscience. It appeals to his superego. So he's his religious feeling. The person feels when he's doing something religious, he feels good about it. That's why it's very hard to... When a person has false religious beliefs, those are the hardest beliefs to uproot. It's an interesting kind of a thing. That the most difficult area of falsehood to deal with is falsehood that concerns a person's religious beliefs. Because in that area, all of his emotions tell him that he's doing the right thing. So he can't see the emotion itself, he can't question it. He doesn't have the motivation to question it. In another area, the guy has false ideas, so he's hard to deal with because his ego might get into the way. He can't learn business, for example.
In business, a person has false ideas. So maybe it's difficult because of his ego, but he also has, he wants to make money and he's losing money, so he's open.
You can see.
Maybe I'm mistaken, but when it
concerns religion,
so then he thinks he's a tzaddik, he's a righteous person. He's doing what God wants him to do.
So it's very hard
to break it down. So that's what he says. The world was then in a situation where it was virtually impossible for it to remove itself from this mistake. He said, "Achen nolad amuda shalom," until the pillar of the world was born. The Rambam is called the amudo shalom, the pillar of the world. Who Avram is? Now, why is he referred to Avram as the pillar of the world?
In what sense?
Because, as we will see, it wasn't only that he discovered the correct idea, but it's how he sought to affect the world with that idea. The pillar of the world, because the world can't exist on the basis of these false ideas. It's not fulfilling its purpose. So in terms of bringing the world back to its purpose, he's the pillar. The Rambam is a...
Avraham Avinu
is a...
is a very key...
very key is not even a good expression. It's probably the most significant individual in history, in the sense of a transformation, in the sense of mankind.
Of course, the Noach Matachem,
that's one thing.
It's true, but Noach, without Noach, the whole thing would have been destroyed.
But that's not that. Noach did not transform the world.
So that means he was sorry.
So he was saved.
But in terms of a individual who has an effect upon the course of history,
Avraham Avinu would probably be the most significant. Of course, you have Moshe Rabbeinu, but before there could be a Moshe Rabbeinu, there had to be an Avraham Avinu.
There had to be an Avraham Avinu.
Alright?
So what I want you to do is
prepare the next, this is very important,
prepare Halacha Gimel.
I'm going to give you some time to do that now.
Halacha Gimel is extremely important.
And it goes into the history of Avraham Avinu and what he did. And many fundamental ideas of Yadus emerge from Halacha Gimel.
What exactly did Avraham Avinu do?
What was his discovery?
And why he was selected by God to be the founder of the Jewish people? What's the concept of the Jewish people? What's the concept of Yadus? And why Avraham was selected to be the founder?
All this is contained. All these major issues are contained.
It'll
emerge from Gimel.
So do a little preparation, and we'll go through that tomorrow.
And then we'll go back and we'll try and answer the question.
The question that you asked
as to the, what was the question asked before? Why everything that happened was the result of the original mistake of Enoch, which was an intellectual mistake. How did it lead? We have to take there was a developmental process.
What was the underlying causality?
How did one thing lead to another? Starting from the mistake of Enoch. We'll try and solve all these things by the end of the week.
In which Avraham Avinu came into being.
Alright?
Yeah.
He mentioned Nigmal Eisan Zeh.
As soon as this
mighty force,
that's Avram,
was weaned,
that is from the earliest,
from his earliest youth,
Hitzchel Lashotate Bedato,
he began to look for Shotate, to move around,
to inquire.
He began to think.
He was, so to speak, he was agitated. He was troubled. He was thinking.
Who cut them while he was still a child?
Hitzchel Lachsho by Yom Halayla,
and he began to ponder, to think by day and by night.
Hutameya,
and he wondered,
Eich Efshir Shiyia Hagalgal Hazeh
Noei Tamed.
How is it possible for these spheres to revolve constantly?
Below Yilo Manik,
and it shouldn't have. Literally, Manik is a leader or controller. It shouldn't have.
Who is responsible? The cause.
Who me is Savi Voto?
And who is the one who caused it to go around? In other words, the argument of causality, where, what? Second something. Yeah, there's a constant motion, in other words. You recognize there's a certain motion in the universe. You study the universe. So how can there be constant motion without a something which originated it and something which keeps it
in motion?
The fish, it
cannot. He's looking at the universe now. The universe can't be responsible for its own movement, so to speak.
These are the types of questions.
The Rambam does not go into all these particulars,
but he was studying nature, and he was asking fundamental.
What you see about Avram is that he was studying nature. Where did he discover God from? What was his book?
His book was the book of nature. That was all that he had.
He didn't have any revelation.
And the types of questions that he was asking
was fundamental kind of questions.
How is it possible that the universe, which operates in an orderly fashion, should be its own cause?
It can't be its own cause. It has to have a cause.
He was looking for the cause, the ultimate cause of the universe.
It's interesting to note, why does he mention this Lacha by Yom Valayla?
Why does he mention that? That would seem to be really
unnecessary.
Why does he have to mention that he began to think by day and by night?
Yeah, that's a good point.
He means to show the nature of the involvement. That's important, because a lot of people tinker. People have hobbies, or they tinker, or they think about things, but it's not their preoccupation. He was preoccupied with this.
And that's why I agree with
what Goldman said. He was completely preoccupied with this type of thing. It was vital to him. He couldn't stop thinking about it.
He couldn't stop thinking about it.
But he didn't have a teacher. Below Modia Dava,
or anyone.
He had no other source to rely upon.
Ella, Meshuka B'ur Kastim.
But he was
steeped in Ur Kastim.
Bein Ovdei Avodah Zarah.
Amongst the idolaters, Hatipshim, the fools.
The other, the Emo.
And his father and his mother,
B'chol Ha'am, and the entire nation, Ovdei Avodah Zarah.
They were all Ovdei Avodah Zarah.
V'hu Ovdei Imam. And he worshipped with him. The libo mishotei umeven.
But his heart was pondering,
was moving, and understanding.
So, what's he saying over here?
What are you saying over here?
Take derech emes.
Until he
reached
the true way. He understood
the true way.
The Haven Kava said it, and he understood the
correct path between us and Hanachono
from his correct understanding. In other words, he had perfected himself in logical thinking, and he recognized the true way.
The Yodah Sheyeshav Eloka Echad,
and he knew that there was one God.
Vehu Manig Agalgo, and he is the one
who is the cause of the spheres, of the movement of the universe.
Vehu Barako.
And he created everything.
The Ein B'chol HaNimsa, and there is not in existence Eloka Chutz Mimenu. So finally, after all of his thinking,
he discovered the ultimate God.
And ultimately, the universe was a source of Chachma, that everything that functioned in the universe functioned according to Chachma, and that if you went back to the ultimate source, there had to be one cause, and this one cause was separate from the universe. And he discovered that.
The Rambam here
does not give you
the particular steps.
Right. I'm just going to ask,
he doesn't give you the particular steps, but
what emerges as clear is that
he was able to discover God
through the universe, through discovering the fact that the universe operates in accordance with Chachma.
There's a world of Chachma,
it's a world of ideas and mind, and therefore it cannot simply, it has to have a source. It can't, there's got to be a being
who is a being of Chachma, which
is responsible for putting this universe together.
The Rambam is not going into the particulars.
But as I said, he discovered God through his knowledge and understanding of the universe, which is similar to what we said to the experience of an Einstein. Anyone who ponders the universe and recognizes the tremendous chachma realizes that this is not something that should just be there. It has to have a source. And that source is the creator, and that creator is beyond the universe.
He's not part of the universe. He's separate from the universe, and he's responsible for the existence of the universe.
That's basically
the idea.
And he knew that the entire world is an Ella.
The Dava Sazar Abraham, Lutar's knew, and the thing which caused this mistake, was because they worshipped the Tachachavim.